Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. For years, Lori Orr believed her Los Angeles firefighter dad was a selfless hero. When Lori's dad was arrested and charged with four murders and countless arson fires, it was her testimony that helped keep him from being sent to death row. Eventually, Lori's search for the truth led her to the dark secrets lurking in her family's past and to an inescapable conclusion about the remorseless killer and arsonist known as the Pillowcase Pyro and his reign of terror in sunny Southern California. Excerpt. A hardware store employee saw the flames as they roared toward him down one of the overstocked aisles. A group of employees ran by, and then he herded them toward a nearby fire escape. The fire was sucking all of the oxygen out of the room, and when they got the door open, the group of panicked shoppers and employees running for their lives were literally pushed out of the door as though they were shot from a cannon. It was coming, coming fast towards us, the flame, the fire, everything. Together with award-winning journalist Frank C. Gerardo Jr., Orr looks back on the journey that took her from love to fear and the search for answers about how the father she loved could also be a thrill-seeking predator. A predator brought to justice by a dogged investigator no one wanted to believe. A master manipulator who participated in the writing of this memoir in hopes that it would redeem him in the eyes of his family and others who trusted and believed in him. The book that we're featuring this evening is Burned, Pyromania, Murder, and a Daughter's Nightmare, with my special guest, journalist and author, Frank C. Gerardo, Jr. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Frank C. Gerardo, Jr.
Hey. Hi, Dan. Thanks for having me on. That was a great introduction.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Good to have you back. Let's talk for a second about how you came to write this book. We mentioned Lori Ann Kovac. Let's talk about a little bit about how you came to write this book.
I really came about it in a sort of circuitous way. I knew John, her dad, when he was a fireman, and I knew him when he was a murder suspect and on trial, and I kind of knew Lori peripherally, but I hadn't really thought much about the case for 25 years or more. And then Wild Blue Press said that they'd been approached by Lori. She'd been writing a diary and needed somebody to kind of help her flesh it out. And I jumped at the chance because, you know, it was a story that I was intimately familiar with and one that affected many of the neighborhoods around where I live. So, her dad is quite an interesting character. He is the most prolific serial arsonist of the 20th century. At least he's been described that way. His story is just absolutely fascinating, primarily because he tells it himself in a work of fiction, or what he calls fiction. And his telling of it kind of led to his arrest and conviction and near sentence to death row. Now, Lori's relationship with her father is very complicated because she grew up believing he was a hero. This was a man who would be on the nightly news talking to reporters about, you know, a fire he helped put out or a dog he helped rescue or a family he helped rescue. Later on in his career, talking about, you know, his investigations into major arson fires. So she saw her dad as a hero. And when he was facing the death penalty, she so believed in him that she showed up at court, testified on his behalf, And many of the jurors said later they were so moved by what she had to say that they, you know, decided that they would not seek the death penalty for John Orr in this very complicated series of arsons that took place over about a 20-year period of time.
You talk about, or you write about in the book, about Glendale, Los Angeles suburb, home of the famed Rose Bowl. Now, you talk about just sort of the, of course, the geography and position of Los Angeles and also Glendale, and you talk about fire season. So, as you do write in the book, tell us a little bit about, for people that don't know, about fire season and propensity of fires, major fires. Tell us a little bit about Glendale and Los Angeles and the history of major wildfires and fires.
So Angelenos like to think there's, you know, four seasons here, and they're not the ones that everyone else, you know, knows. If you live in Canada or if you live in Boston, you have, you know, a real solid spring, a solid summer, a solid fall, and a solid winter. But in Southern California, our seasons are a lot different. And one of our seasons, and the scariest one, is fire season. And it usually starts, you know, sometime between June and August. It doesn't have a set day. You know, it's not the first day of summer. And it's marked by very dry conditions, high winds, for, you know, massive fires. And, you know, over the last few years, I'm sure you've seen news reports about some of these fires. What's interesting about L.A. and Glendale, which is sort of where this book is centered, is that many of the homes in this part of the Southland are built right into these hillsides. And these hillsides are covered with, you know, dried desert grasses, tinder, if you will, and creosote and other sorts of plants that, you know, naturally burn. And when they do, they burn hot. When the wind blows, it can, you know, take a fire of a couple acres up to 100 acres in a matter of minutes. And, you know, if there's houses anywhere near, you're not going to be protecting your property. You're going to be running for your life with whatever possessions you can grab. John, Lori's dad, an arson investigator in Glendale, knew about this stuff. And, you know, his job initially was to go and inspect weed-strewn lots to tell people to cut back their weeds, watch out for, you know, fire season. And so he, you know, it turns out that he was actually able to manipulate people that didn't follow the rules the way that he thought they should. One of the stories that we uncovered for the book Burned was John going to the home of a city planning commissioner in Glendale. I'll tell you a bit about Glendale in a sec. And telling the guy he needed to cut the weeds in his backyard. The man didn't feel that he had to. And within a matter of days, he had a fire that burned, you know, down the hillside and nearly right to his front door. Of course, the man believed later on that it may have been set by John. Glendale. So to understand Los Angeles, you have to envision it as not just being, you know, L.A., palm trees, Hollywood, Beverly Hills, but actually a collection of 88 very different communities. And those communities have, in many cases, their own police departments and their own fire departments. They all have different standards of, you know, what it takes to be a fireman or what it takes to be a policeman. And within those, you know, 88 communities are 12 million people. So predators, especially in the 70s and the 80s and even the 90s, could move pretty easily from community to community without, you know, stirring up a lot of attention. And that was sort of John's forte. He was very good at making his way into a place and not really being seen or noticed, and than, you know, finding a way to take advantage of a situation where he could set a fire.
Let's go back to Lori's life and talk about growing up with her father, John Orr, and then that family changing and her mother being with someone named Jerry, so her life changing dramatically. But, of course, she knows her father and talks about that in your book about growing up with him. So tell us about her early life with her father and her mother and what happened and to set her life in a different course.
Sure. So, you know, Lori is one of two children that John had with his first wife, Jody. They were, you know, kind of a close-knit family. They, you know, they lived in a home very close to John's parents and very close to Jody's parents. John was a serial philanderer, and eventually he and Jody split. She had the kids, and John, you know, went on with his life. Lori, you know, didn't know this was going on. She saw her father through the prism of this man who was a hero, fighting hero, always working, always out there protecting the citizens of Los Angeles County and of Glendale, where they lived. And her mom, Jody, had, you know, had her flaws. She hooked up with a man named Jerry. Jerry wasn't the kindest stepfather that one could ask for. In fact, he was abusive to Lori's mom and abusive to Lori and her sister, Carrie. And they hoped, you know, they saw their dad, you know, as being, you know, a savior perhaps. But, you know, the interesting thing is that John was so wrapped up in himself, and he'll tell you this today, that, you know, he didn't really see what was happening with his girls, or didn't care about it. And, you know, sort of ignored their cries for help. And some of their cries for help, you know, weren't the verbal cries, "Hey, Dad, come and get us out of this situation." You know, they were running away. They were drinking at a, you know, young age. They were engaging in, you know, some dangerous behaviors, because they didn't like the situation that they were in with their mom. And so they're living in this kind of, oh, you know, Cinderella-esque situation. And here's their dad, this hero, and they're always looking at him as sort of being the man that can rescue them from being Cinderella. It didn't happen. But that didn't keep them from loving him. They, you know, went on trips with their dad occasionally. They, you know, were introduced to subsequent girlfriends and wives. And, in fact, you know, we got some family pictures of one of John's weddings where, you know, the girls are there and happy, beautifully dressed. And, you know, on the outside, this appeared to be a flawed but all-American family.
Let's go back to some of the things that you write about, in that he had this workaholic nature. He took, not only when he finally did get a job with the fire department, or any job he had, he took as many jobs as he could. And so let's talk about some of that major characteristic that drives him through his entire life, basically, that he's this workaholic. And also that, before we talk about that, his disappointment in trying to become a member of law enforcement, how that shapes his attitude and how that helps him get into a career in with the fire department.
Okay. This is, I think, really gets to the heart of John Orr, his workaholic nature. As a young guy, a young teen, John was on the make, looking to ways to make money. You know, he did paper routes, he did, you know, car washes, he did anything that he could to make a buck. And, you know, I guess that sort of served him well. He was an awkward teenager growing up, but, you know, he didn't want for money. He, after high school. John was in high school in the 60s, and that was when the Vietnam War was raging, really. And, you know, the options for a young man who wasn't necessarily college-bound were few. One of them was get drafted or join the military. John decided to join the Air Force. And in the Air Force, he followed through on a lifelong dream, and the lifelong dream was to be a firefighter. So John gets trained as a firefighter in the Air Force, and he's sent to Spain, and he performs, you know, moderately well. It's about that time, too, that he and Jody get married, and they're living on the base in Spain. And John is exhibiting a characteristic that will come to mark him for the rest of his life, and that is working all the time. Here's Jody, his newlywed wife, and she never sees the guy because even when he's not on shift, he's out working or palling around with his buddies or, you know, looking for ways to make more money. After John was discharged, honorably so, he came back to Los Angeles and decided that, you know, his career path probably lay in law enforcement. And he took a job as a security guard at Sears department store and sought out employment with the Los Angeles Police Department. In the late 60s and early 70s, LAPD would put out constant calls for recruitment. So he got into a recruiting class, headed over to LAPD, and took the psychological evaluation, which is, at that time, a very complicated test. You know, like a Minnesota multiphasic personality inventory type of thing, MMPI. And, you know, the evaluators there, after looking at the test, saw that he had some tendencies that would not make him a good cop. You know, he exhibited a personality that, you know, is borderline sociopathic and potentially psychopathic. LAPD called him in, told him he was rejected. It devastated him. Then, you know, so involved in his career as a security guard at Sears, he figured that he'd be a natural cop.
Right.
Because he so knew his community in Los Angeles, he figured that he'd be a great cop in L.A. So he decided, well, if I can't be a cop, I'll be a fireman. And he went and applied for a job with the Los Angeles Fire Department. And the L.A. Fire Department, big city fire department, he did okay on the psychological tests, and he did okay on most of the entry tests. But in the academy class, one of the requirements was that you carry a large ladder for a certain amount of feet and be able to put the ladder up against a window and then get up on it. And John was physically unable to do it. And again, this inability to do this caused the Los Angeles Fire Department to tell him, hey, you know what, sorry, but you're not suitable. You're not physically fit for the kind of work that we need Los Angeles firefighters to do. So thanks for your application. Sorry. So again, John walks away from a dream job extremely bitter, angry at the system, angry at, you know, the bureaucrats that are holding him back, and kind of angry at the city that he loved. Now, remember, I told you that Los Angeles is a community of many communities. And just because Los Angeles itself wasn't hiring, other cities were. Glendale, a neighbor of Los Angeles just to the north, had a fire department, and they still do. At that time, they were among the, let's just say the lowest paid and probably lacking, you know, the significant kind of training that a fire department would need in its personnel. And so John was able to convince the folks in Glendale that he was a good match, and they hired him and brought him on board as a firefighter. Well, the pay was low, hours were long, And that meant John needed to keep his job as a security guard at Sears, and he did. It also meant that, you know, every now and then he'd even take a third job. On a couple of occasions for, you know, months at a time, he worked as a clerk at a 7-Eleven, constantly looking for ways to make money. Some of that money, you know, went toward child support and, you know, and later on alimony and those types of things that, you know, John would need to pay as he went from girlfriend to girlfriend and marriage to marriage. He just had this, you know, desire to be out sort of, you know, doing something. He earned quite a reputation as a security guard. He, as he tells it, you know, he developed a knack for nailing shoplifters. You know, I mean, if you've ever been in a department store where they catch a shoplifter, you probably have never even seen it because they do it very quietly, you know.
Right.
But John would always make a big show of it. And, you know, he didn't mind being armed. He didn't mind chasing people out into the parking lot. He didn't mind scuffling with people if they took stuff. And he didn't mind. He always wanted to be the hero. And being a department store security guard gave him that opportunity. As a rookie firefighter, some of those, what we would call law enforcement skills, you know, he put them to work. There's stories of John driving around in a city fire truck and spotting vandals, you know, from a local gang. And, you know, rather than calling the police department for backup, you know, John makes an effort to apprehend these men. And in one case, he even gets into, you just imagine this, right? He's in a car chase with some bad guys in L.A., and he's driving a fire truck, you know, and they're driving their car. And an accident ensues during the course of this chase, and John gets out and holds one of them at gunpoint. The Burbank Police Department comes up and arrests him. And everybody that, you know, knows John, you know, laughs at this part of his personality. You know, he's kind of the, you know, Paul Blart mall cop of his day.
Right. Now let's get to some of the what they call now, what they said at the time as well, was that this was an epidemic of intentional fires in the 80s in this LA, Los Angeles County. And then you talk about right about October 10th, 1984, game 2 of the World Series, San Diego Padres versus Detroit Tigers. And you said the streets of South Pasadena were quiet, but a little fire started at a grocery store in Pasadena. And an hour later, another Pasadena Fire Department investigation. Tell us what happens on October 10th, 1984, starting with the small fires and what it leads to.
Sure. So so Los Angeles in the early and mid-80s had this epidemic of what were called potato chip fires. And this is surprising. It was surprising to me when I was researching the book. Mm-hmm. Potato chips are some of the most flammable things in a grocery store. So don't try this at home, but if you go on YouTube, you can look it up and you'll see that you take a bag of Doritos or a bag of potato chips and you can get it going pretty good. So there was a series of small fires and potato chip racks at grocery stores throughout what I guess would be the San Gabriel Valley, a community, you know, a group of communities adjacent to Glendale, adjacent to Los Angeles. These fires are minorly destructive, but nothing major. And on this particular night, a couple of them took some grocery stores that were, you know, minutes apart. But something else happened that night too. There was a at the same time that fire department in South Pasadena was responding to a grocery store fire, a fire broke out in a hardware store, and the hardware store was called Ole's. It was a prominent chain of hardware stores in Southern California, and this fire, although nobody knew it at the time, broke out in a stack of poly foam, you know, like mattress type of and pillow type of material. That stuff then was largely made out of a derivative of petroleum and gasoline that's highly flammable. And as the fire department was chasing down these potato chip fires and putting them out, this fire in the hardware store began to build, and it built rapidly. The hardware store, actually two buildings that had been put together, they were separated by a mechanical fire door, so that if a fire were to break out there, this door would slam shut, sealing off, you know, one area from another, and limiting the amount of damage. Turns out that this fire was so massive and spread so quickly that it caused a mechanical failure in that fire door that trapped people inside. The fire grew quickly. It created like a weather system of its own. It sucked out all the oxygen from the air in this building and exploded in a force that, you know, many people hadn't seen. One employee of the store described going out, you know, crawling through smoke and heat to get out of the building. And when he got outside, his skin just melted right off. His hair was burned. People were panicked. They were running and trying to get out as fast as they could. Sadly, four people ended up being trapped inside and killed. Among them were a grandmother, Ada Deal, and her son, her two-year-old grandson, Matthew Troidel. Another man by the name of Jimmy Satina, who was a 17-year-old high school baseball star in Pasadena. And then a woman named Carolyn Krause, who, you know, essentially, you know, young married woman who just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time on her shift. By the time the fire department arrived after putting out the potato chip fire fully engulfed, these people were certainly dead. And, you know, it was a huge tragedy in the community. Anytime there's a big fire like that, the powers that be are called out. It just so happens that in the community of South Pasadena, arson investigations are largely done by the county sheriff. It has a large arson and explosives team. This is an interesting little thing here. So John Orr, also an arson, or at least, you know, fledgling arson investigator at the time, thought that he should be the lead investigator on this case. And when the sheriff was out there investigating it, the sheriff determined that the cause of the fire was electrical in nature, and very quickly shut down any inquiries into whether or not it was arson, whether or not it could have been caused by something other than a malfunctioning light bulb, and, you know, quickly wrote a report, put it out to the media within 24 hours of the fire. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, the investigation was done. Well, now let me tell you something about this fire. Fire was set by John Orr. So were the potato chip fires. They were intentional diversions. And he was very, very upset that the sheriff's department didn't recognize his handiwork as an arsonist. And immediately, within days, two other Ole stores, the hardware store, the chain, were hit with similar fires. Nobody was killed in either of them. The damage wasn't great. But the investigators never linked them to the big one that happened at Oley's either. They just kind of sat there as being, you know, part of the pillowcase pyro, which is what they called this arsonist, and the potato chip arsonist investigations. So start having all these fires and all this damage. It calls into the attention of the ATF. So at this point in time, the ATF is now, you know, kind of looking at these series of fires. But everybody's accepted the sheriff's take on Oley's and not thrown it into the mix.
So, what does John Orr...
It's just a huge tragedy. Sorry.
What does John...
I'm sorry.
In criticizing the decision from the fire chief, what does this wannabe John Orr have to say about the cause of the fire, contrary to what this other police chief has concluded?
Well, so you know, John's going around telling everybody it's an arson fire. I can go in there and show you exactly where it started. I mean, he's literally going to point them in the direction of the point of origin of the fire, of course, that he started. And personally, for him, if he were able to have done that, you know, he would have been looked at as this, you know, great sort of Sherlock Holmesian investigator, you know, able to deduce from a bare minimum of clues how this massive fire had started. And he was frustrated in that by the sheriff saying, nope, it's electrical fire. That's what it is. You're not going in there. You're not looking at anything. I'm telling you the way it is. And that's that. The arrogance of the county sheriff's fire investigator really upset John. It massively upset him. And it only upset him because he didn't get credit for the fire that he started. So it was, you know, it's really, like, for us to think about this, it's odd, right? It's backwards. You'd think that a guy that, you know, was engaged in criminal activity would not want to have anyone discern that he was involved in it. But John was certain they wouldn't catch him. He wanted his, you know, his alter ego, his, you know, hidden persona to get credit for the fire that killed four innocent people.
There's a task force that gets set up in response, and you write, but what is John Orr's response to this in terms of his advancement in career? He doesn't get this recognition that he wants, so what does he do in response to that in terms of becoming the kind of respected fire professional that he wants to be?
Well, so, I mean, that's exactly what he does. So John, you know, John doesn't, has the sheriff's department doesn't respect him. You know, it's clear that he's not going to, you know, be the guy that figures this fire out. So a task force is set up, you know, in the communities of the foothills, places where, you know, fire weather is likely to destroy homes. And, you know, John very quickly becomes an officer in the club. You know, and, you know, starts to establish himself as a respected arson investigator, affiliated with other arson investigators, and a sleuth of, you know, sort of legendary proportions. And, you know, arson investigators from around the region at first, and then from around the state, and soon from around the country, sought his advice. Because he had, you know, been a part of this task force and sort of proved himself as a pretty good investigator. You know, the intent was likely to, you know, be able to be the guy that pointed out fires like the Oley's fire, you know, be able to go into another situation like that and point out, hey, this is arson, and make the sheriff and everybody else that didn't believe it look bad.
In terms of fires being abated, we talked about the 80s. In this rise for him to gain respect as a fire investigator and his goal to become captain, what's the situation in terms of fires being set in the area? And what does the task force do in response?
So there's a, I got to tell you, this guy set so many darn fires that, you know, this so the, this task force really it wants to, you know, get down to the brass tacks of what's happening here. And I'll just give you an example. So they, one of the things that they do in the late 80s is they have this task force, and then they set up the task force so that they can go and teach each other how to investigate fire. And they go to, there's a conference that's held up in, you know, several communities away in Northern California. And John's invited to the conference. And on his way home from the conference, he lights several fires. In fact, actually, let me go back a bit. While they're at the conference, John lights a fire that destroys a fabric store. And and a fabric store that's a lot like Ole's, you know, it has that polyfoam in it. And it, the fire, while it's covered on, you know, television in the community, doesn't really get a lot of recognition for being an arson fire. John goes home from the conference and on the way home lights four or five more fires, all at fabric stores between Fresno and Los Angeles. This has this the task force, like, we got, you know, what's going on here? John is suggesting to his friends and others that what's happening is that there's a serial arsonist who knows that all the arson investigators are together at this conference and wants to show off. But something happened along the way. One of the fires that he set was in Bakersfield, California. And there was an old-time arson investigator there by the name of Marvin Casey. And Marv Casey went out to this. It was a dud fire. It probably did, you know, less than a couple hundred dollars worth of damage at a fabric store in the main part of Bakersfield. Your listeners probably know Bakersfield as being the, you know, the home of Merle Haggard and Buck Owens, but it's a big oil community. There's a lot of families that live there, and it does have seasoned investigators like Marv Casey. So Marv goes out to this fire, he looks at it, and here is the device. He finds it that sets the fire. The device consists of a cigarette, three matches, a piece of rubber band, and then some lined notebook paper set up as a tent. Now, the way this works is the cigarette, you let this, back then cigarettes would burn. They didn't have retardant in them. The right. cigarette would burn. When it got down to the match heads would flare up. The flare from the match heads would set the tented paper on fire. The flame from the tented paper would go into the polyfoam, and the polyfoam, being a gasoline product, would ignite. Well, in this case, for some reason, the fire didn't take. The cigarette device, the matches, and the paper were still there. Marv Casey knew that there had been a conference of arson investigators just in the neighborhood. And noticed that there had been fires on the road, the highway between Fresno and Los Angeles. So he went to the ATF and he asked them, hey, I found a fingerprint and I'd like to run this fingerprint through the database of firefighters that attended this conference to see if there's a match. See if we have a fireman who, you know, may be setting fire. And the ATF and other investigators were horrified by the suggestion that a fireman might be an arsonist. They told him, no way, can't do it. This is outrageous. There's something else going on here. Do not pursue that line of investigation. Well, you know, old Marv said, okay, I mean, if that's what you want me to do, that's what I'm going to do. But, you know, he knew in his heart that they weren't going to solve these fires. And he believed that there would be, you know, more fires to follow. And he was right. You know, 2 years later, there's another, again, same group. This is the same task force of people that are looking for the pillowcase pyro and the potato chip arsonist and this guy that's making his way up and down the state. They meet in the town of San Luis Obispo, and that's on the coast. It's a nice place. It's a good place to have a conference. And sure as heck, at the end of this conference, there are a series of five fires in hardware stores and fabric stores along the road between San Luis Obispo and Los Angeles. So Marv Casey down in Bakersfield catches wind of this. It reminds him of what happened in, you know, 2 years earlier in 87. He's got that piece of paper and that fingerprint, and he again goes to the ATF and he says, "Hey, you know, you remember a couple years ago, I wanted to run this against firefighters. You guys said no, but it's just too coincidental that this thing happened again." And the ATF said, "Well, all right, look, if you can narrow down the number of people that you want to run a print on, then we'll take a look at it." So he gets a list of firefighters from Los Angeles area that attended the 87 conference, compares it to a list of firefighters that attended the 89 conference, finds out there's a handful of them that attended both, and says, "All right, here, I've got a list of five guys, 10 guys. One of the names on the list, by the way, is John Orr." He submits the list. He submits the print. The ATF runs it, and no match comes back. So now Marv's, you know, really scratching his head. And it really doesn't make sense to him. How can it be that here's these fires, here's these conferences of firefighters, here's this pattern of, you know, hardware stores and stuff between L.A. and San Luis Obispo and between L.A. and Fresno? He's kind of stumped. ATF is kind of stumped. And John knows that, you know, and he's not really feeling the heat, and he's probing people in the task force to find out, you know, what they know. Is there, you know, an investigation where he might be the suspect? You know, is there something that he, because he's close to them, you know, that he can learn about their investigation? He's trying to figure it out. It's not that simple, though. For John, and it's not that simple for investigators either, because it's going to be about two more years before they finally hook them up.
You talk about in June 27th, 1990, 66 homes destroyed or damaged, $50 million in damage, and you're getting witnesses that are coming forward to describe possible suspects.
Right.
So how do they progress with that information?
Well, so I got to tell you this. So this is the Glendale, what they call the College Hills fire. And this was a massive wildfire set on a hillside in a neighborhood that is ripe to be, to have a wildfire. That particular year, fire season came a little bit early. Temperatures were hot, humidity levels were extremely low. It hadn't rained much in the prior months of April, May, and early June, so the grasses were tinder dry. And somebody set a fire, and the fire burned up a hillside and was out. You know, this is an interesting thing. This fire was out in a day, but by the time it was out, you know, millions of dollars in damage, homes gone, families, taken out of their neighborhood. There were witnesses, people, that saw things. But I'm gonna tell you a story that I heard after I wrote the book, and I wish I had heard it when I wrote it. A friend of mine worked for a local TV station, And he had a crew that was doing a story on somebody in the College Hills. And the film crew was a reporter, a cameraman, and a microphone guy, just happened to be in the neighborhood where this fire started at the time that it started. And they got, you know, some early footage of the flames as they made their way up this hillside. And this is just so great. The next morning, John Orr is at the TV station, the Fox TV station, demanding that they turn over the tape that they had shot that day, as, you know, part of his investigation. And the man told me that, you know, he later on found out that the reason John Orr, and it's obvious, I mean, you know, but the reason that John Orr wanted that tape was so that he could find out whether or not they caught him setting the fire. They were that close to him. The people did see him, and he was very noticeable in an unnoticeable way, you know, because it's that thing of that dissonance that you get sometimes, right? You don't really put two and two together. This fire, now remember, this is a fast-moving fire, and it blows right through the point of origin and up this hillside and into these homes, so much, so quick and so fast that investigators were able to go to the point of origin within hours after it started, and they noticed that John was dragging his feet, that he didn't really have a strong desire to go to the spot where they believed the fire had been set. And then when he did go there, he acted so unusual and suspicious that, you know, later on it would key people into that maybe there was something more there. John told reporters that, you know, he knew how the fire started. He had seen a device that started it. But when his superiors asked him for it, asked him to write a report, and asked him to do follow-up and find a suspect, he wouldn't deliver. Almost refused to deliver in an insubordinate way. And it began to draw some attention to him. At the same time, Marvin Casey and the ATF, roughly about the same time, there's a lot of little intervening facts, but we'll just go right back to Marv Casey and the ATF and that fingerprint. They run that, eventually they're going to run that print again, and John knows it. And he also has been setting other fires, more hardware store fires, this time in Los Angeles, in communities that are, you know, a little bit south of the city instead of north. And he's seen at the scene of one of them, like oddly, a guy that knows him, sees him at the scene of this fire. And people are starting to piece it together. They in 1991, there's another one of these arson conferences. This time it's up in San Luis Obispo again. And this time they have a pretty good sense that, you know, John is a suspect. And they put a tracker on his car. Police had never done this before. It was, you know, new GPS technology, and so they put a tracker on his car. And he's at the conference, and he comes out, and he sees the antenna from the tracker sitting, kind of pointing out from under the bumper, and he gets in his car, and he hauls ass out of the parking lot, drives down to the San Luis Obispo Sheriff's Department, and tells him that there's a bomb under his car. Well, you know, the ATF that puts his tracker on his car, and the detectives are horrified. They're like, this guy, he's going to blow up our tracking device, and we're not going to get it. We're not going to be able to follow him anymore. So they call in to the sheriff's department while Orr's there and they tell him, hey, look, this, we're to the ATF. We're not going to tell you why, but there's a tracker on this guy's car. You can, whatever you want to do, pretend, just play along with them. It's not a bomb. Don't do an investigation. We'll figure this out later. So he was pretty slick, and he knew that they were on to him. And they were able, subsequently to that, to get another tracker on him. And they tracked him to the scene of a fire on the Warner Brothers movie studio lot where his wife at the time worked. And evidence is starting to pile up, and now they run that fingerprint for a third time. And what they did was they expanded the database of prints that they could run it against. And one of the pieces of information that they had was the LAPD database. And remember, when he applied for that job at LAPD, well, at that time, right, they had to give him his fingerprints. And so they had him in there. They made him. They figured out that, well, John was, in fact, the guy that set that fire in Bakersfield. He was the guy that, in fact, set the fires in Fresno and San Luis Obispo. And they showed up at his house, and this is a federal case, and arrested him in connection with, I want to say, 8 hardware store fires in Central California.
You talk about
and it's big news.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
You talk about, too, we just, something that's very, very striking was that during all in all of this, he's in the midst of an investigation, but he makes his way finally onto the cover of the Los Angeles Times at the same time that he's being suspected, and people don't want to believe it, but end up believing that this. And you talk about a dogged ATF worker named Matessa that's instrumental in this investigation.
Well,
and also,
yeah, so Mike, yeah, sorry, go ahead. I apologize.
What I wanted to, before we talk about it a little bit later, let's talk about the origin of points of origin. Why is he writing this book? And you write about that he sends a draft of the book to somebody in the fire department, and they forward it to someone else. So it's a eerie confluence of events that are going on at the same time that he's this suspect and doesn't quite know it for a while till the surveillance is obvious to him. So tell us about the book that he's working on, Points of Origin.
Yeah, see, there's a lot of stuff going on in his life all at the same time, and it's like you wonder, you know, especially as a writer, when I was writing this, I wondered how he kept all these different personas together. And you can, I mean, just this whole manic personality, right? Where does this come from? So at the time that all this is happening, John is in the midst of writing a book, a work of fiction called Points of Origin. And the story of Points of Origin is about 2 firemen, one of whom is this amazing investigator named Phil Langtree, and the other is a firefighter who happens to be an arsonist named Aaron Stiles. So the book is essentially a cat and mouse game between Phil and Aaron. In chapters about Aaron, there are these very detailed descriptions of arson fires and how the arsonist is aroused by these fires, sexually aroused by them. And he's mixing, you know, the images of large-breasted women with images of flames, burning up potato chip racks. When he gets angry at people, he finds ways to get back at them by starting fires, and he loves to watch the fire department respond to these fires. In the heart of the book is the description of a fire that's a lot like Ole's. That, remember that fire in South Pasadena that killed those 4 innocent people. And Aaron, in the book, Points of Origin, sets a fire in a hardware store, in foam rubber mattresses, and the fire spreads rapidly, and ends up killing, in the book, 5 people, including a 2-year-old. And there's a lot of little things, you know. So this is kind of inside writer baseball, right? But, you know, to make a good story, you got to have dialogue, right? It can't just be description. You got to have some dialogue. So sure. there's a snippet of dialogue in the book where Aaron overhears a grandmother and grandfather tell their grandchild that when they're done shopping, they will buy him ice cream at the Baskin-Robbins. Well, it turns out that snippet of conversation wasn't just made up. It's, in fact, something that the actual arsonist of the Always Fire probably overheard. John is shopping this book. He's desperately trying to get it published because his idea is that, you know, if he can publish this book, it can be made into a movie, and, you know, he's living the Hollywood dream, right? He got his book optioned. It became a movie, and now he's not just arson investigator John Orr. He's, you know, the next Joseph Wamba, right?
Right.
A guy who has some working knowledge of his profession. So his captain read the book and immediately saw the strong parallels between the Cowles fire in Points of Origin and the Always fire in real life. You know, it raised many red flags for him. And it raised, later on, there's other parts of the books of that book that raised flags for others too. Now, all of this is coming, you know, is sort of being discovered at the same time the feds are working these cases up in Central California. But they're beginning to see that, you know, or have a sense of who John is, and they're getting a better sense of it from the book. And probably, I think most stunning to all of them was after the young kid died, after the baby died and the grandmother died and the people died in the hardware store,
sure.
In the book, the arsonist says something along the lines of, well, they deserved it. They didn't get out of there fast enough. So you're really looking into the mind of a, you know, cold-hearted killer, and people are starting to see that.
Mm-hmm. You talk quite a bit about his personal life, and I know it doesn't have that much relevance, but what is characterized, he's married 4 times, and Lori and her sister say that all they remember is, you know, the rare visits was that there was always women around. What characterized his personal life with these women in terms of anything out of the ordinary?
Well, so John was heavily into B&D, bondage and discipline, rough sex, rape fantasies, control over the women that he was with. And, you know, just about every woman who he was either, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend with or married to describes these scenarios where, you know, John is essentially raping them. And it's a power, you know, it's sort of a power thing where he's exerting some sort of power over women. Forensic psychologists will tell you that, you know, the arsonist, the personality of an arsonist is somebody who is powerless. And the personality of a rapist is sometimes also the personality of somebody who's powerless. So you have this confluence of, you know, really dangerous personality types all pent up in this man. His kid, you know, obviously his kids don't see any of this. I mean, his kids are, you know, they meet the wives and the girlfriends and all the dogs that come and go from the house and, you know, and all the different living scenarios. And you know, they kind of, you know, like kids do, they compartmentalize and go with the flow and, you know, figure out how to navigate their father's weird personal life at the same, you know, I mean, surfacely weird. They don't know the weird stuff. At the same time, you know, that they're really reaching out in hopes of having a relationship with them, with him, and he's not giving himself over to them to have a relationship with them. And it's, you know, it's a strain, obviously, on them. And again, you know, as you asked, all this is happening at the same time, right? Same time he's starting the fires, the same time he's about to get caught, right? And the relationship with his girls is becoming more and more strained. And he's writing this book and having, it's hard to like talk about, it's hard to write about people's sex lives and to talk about, because, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, everybody has their own thing, right? But some of the things that he does, you know, would appear to be, you know, rather out of the ordinary, and certainly not, you know, in the bounds of what might be described as typically normal. And I think the reason that I included this in the book, right? The reason that it's there is because it goes to the personality of the, you know, the arsonist, right? The controlling personality of the arsonist.
You talk about why I mention it is because of the point of origin, the perpetrator in this fictional account that they used at trial and they used in this investigation to shed some light on his personality and motivations and, you know, details about the crimes that he writes about supposedly fictionally, that the perpetrator in this was sexually motivated to do these arsons,
yep.
Which is very interesting.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good question, Dan, and a good observation. The perpetrator, the fictional perpetrator in Points of Origin, was sexually motivated to start fires. And in the body of the work, it's, by the way, I don't know if you've seen it, but there, you know, it's probably 200 pages. It's really thin. I don't want to say it's crappy, but it's very formulaic, except for these like very vivid descriptions, right? So, in one part of the book, there is Aaron, the arsonist, rapes and kills a woman with whom he is infatuated. And, there are investigators who claim that John did the same thing. And they, you know, they can even pinpoint the case where he did it, but he's never been tried for it. And, you know, this case remains unsolved. Now, I asked him about it. I read the book. I asked him, I said, John, you know, listen, over in Burbank and Glendale, there are people that believe that you're not just, an arsonist who killed people in South Pasadena, but, you know, you raped and murdered at least one woman. And he's, no, I didn't. But, you know, you have this persona where you engage in all this kinky sex. And, you know, and he cannot slip out of this thing. He turns it around. It becomes about, you know, the investigators don't like him because he was so good at what he did. And, you know, it's too bad they can't catch the real arsonist and don't know all the facts type of deal. That's John Orr in a nutshell.
Now, he goes to trial. He's out on $50,000 bail. Like you write in the book, the story isn't as big as it maybe should be because there's so many other events that are overshadowing. You talk about Rodney King and that case. Tell us about, as you write, the sentencing for those fires and for those crimes, but also how the investigation continues afterwards to include that Ole's department store and basically the murder of those four people.
Okay. So 91, 91, 92, there's a lot happening in L.A., not just the arrest of John Orr, but, the Rodney King story that everyone knows occupied the media's attention for, you know, a good year. And it wasn't just, you know, the incessant playing of that video, that horrific video of Rodney King getting beaten, but it was, you know, the relationship with the Los Angeles Police Department, and then, of course, the trial of the four police officers, their acquittal, and the riots, you know, that followed, or the civil unrest, if you will. And so, you know, John Orr, the Glendale fire captain, arrested for, you know, 8 minor arsons in the Central Valley, didn't occupy a lot of media attention. Now, what happened was he goes to trial, and trial is not looking good. But ultimately, he pleads guilty to an arson fire. It was a single arson fire. Enters a guilty plea to a single arson fire. A small fire. I think it cost $64 in damage at a builder's emporium in North Hollywood. And John is given a 10-year federal prison sentence, you know, in this instance. And he thinks that while he's in the clear. But it turns out that, you know, the fire that he pled guilty to is one in which bears many of the similarities of the fires in South Pasadena, and the fire, you know, and on and on and on, right? And so now the L.A. County, now remember, this is a federal case where he's convicted, but now L.A. County is determined that they're going to prosecute him for the Olley's fire. Now, this is going to be difficult. This is not an easy task because, you know, their L.A. County's own investigator said, well, that Olley's fire, you know, that wasn't an arson, that was an electrical fire.
Right.
So it took almost 6 years pieces together into a criminal case that LA County could prosecute for the Olley's fire, the four murders, the, you know, multiple homes that were destroyed in Glendale, the fire on the Burbank lot, and a couple of other, you know, hits or misses, around the region. The court case. This is where I'm going to stumble a little bit. I don't remember all the statistics, but I was very fortunate that in the writing of the book, I was able to get access to not just all the documents that related to the case. I mean everything, including, by the way, most of the reports that John wrote as a firefighter.
Wow.
And within the files that I had were John's notes. And he took very copious notes on every one of the witnesses, on his attorneys, on evidence that was presented. So I was able to, you know, sort of synthesize in my memory, which, you know, was fading, having gone to the trial, there were certain things that I didn't remember, but I was able to, you know, piece the trial back together, and the investigation, you know, through all of these various documents, that I was really fortunate to have. It was I guess as a writer, you'd call it a gold mine. On top of that, sure. We talked about points of origin, but, you know, John also wrote a second book called Points of Truth. And Points of Truth is his autobiography and his defense in the criminal cases that he was confronted with. So Points of Truth, now remember, Points of Origin is, you know, so let's say 200 pages. You know, I mean, it's super formulaic. Tropes everywhere, you know, you can figure out the plot pretty quickly. Points of Truth is probably about 400 pages, very densely written. It starts out with him, you know, as a 5-year-old describing his first arson fire, but completely not admitting that he said it, and then going through his entire 45-year history of as an arsonist, describing every fire that he ever investigated, describing every girlfriend, every wife, every relationship that he ever had, describing his feelings about being rejected as a police officer, his feelings about being rejected as a firefighter, his feelings about his promotions, his superiors, the arrests that he made when he was a security guard. And what's interesting to me is that after reading these two books, I realized that, you know, John has two personalities, just like, you know, his firefighter arsonist and his good guy firefighter. And his books are the complete opposite of what they pretend to be. Points of Origin, which purports to be a work of fiction, is actually a work of nonfiction. And Points of Truth, which purports to be nonfiction, is actually fiction. So, John turns everything upside down in everything. And it's, I guess, you know, in a relationship, you'd call it gaslighting. But, you know, it's clear that he's, you know, super manipulative, and this is his way of being. Before writing the book, I wrote him a letter, and I said, John, I'm writing this book. I'd like you to participate. He said, I will if you can get my daughter to write me a letter and tell me that she's participating in it also. So Lori wrote him a letter and said, hey, I'm working on this book with Frank. We're going to publish it. We knew then the book would be called Burned. And we knew then it would be published by Wild Blue Press. She told him, she said, Dad, I hate to tell you this, but, you know, you are not going to look good when this book comes out. So John didn't write back to her. He wrote to me and he said, well, my daughter says she's working with you. So, all right, you know, ask any questions you want to ask. I'll provide you with any information that I can. And I'm hoping that at the end of you writing the book, when the process is all over, that you get to a point where you see me as being innocent.
Right.
Okay. You know, I mean, whatever. I write the whole thing, and we correspond a lot during the course of this, and talked on the phone a couple of times. And then, you know, at the end of it, I wrote him a letter, and I said, okay, John, the book's done. I'll make sure you get a copy of it. I just want you to know that your daughter was right. You don't look good. And in fact, I'm more convinced than I ever was that you're guilty of the Olley's fire and a bunch of other fires, you know, that hurt people and damaged property. And it took a while. You know, a couple of weeks went by, and I get a letter, and it's from John. And it's about a 10-page letter. The first three or four pages are him, you know, talking about how hard it is to be away from his family and, you know, how he's done his time and, you know, how he plans to do his time and the future and, you know, how he might get out. And then he says, halfway through the letter, he says, oh, you know, you're wrong about me. I'm not guilty. But since you think that, it's okay. Lots of people think I'm guilty. I just want you to know that I imagine that when you're done with this, you'll probably write another book, maybe two or three other books, and you'll want to talk to guys in the joint. Well, I've been in for 35 years, and I know a lot of people, including Bobby Beausoleil, who was with the Manson family. So if you ever need a connection or a good word on your behalf, just let me know.
Yeah.
Sincerely, John. Yeah. Yeah. Manipulative run until the very end. Yeah.
You write in the book, of course, the devastating story of Lori and having to hear the news of her father's arrest initially and then having to have the realization that her father is this serial arsonist and a murderer. And she has to go to the trial to make sure that he doesn't receive the death penalty. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, this is a, you know, nerve-wracking situation for her to be in because at the point of the trial in which she was asked to, you know, speak for her dad, she really didn't know what he was accused of. She thought, oh, you know, he's, you know, they're saying he set some fires, and there's no way in heck my dad would set fires, and, you know, this is a bunch of crap, and I'll happily go. So she shows up, and everybody's staring at her. It's a packed courtroom. I'll never, you know, I mean, I certainly remember it. It's a death penalty case. Courtroom's packed, and she comes in. They start asking, you know, all these questions. Is your dad good? Yep. Dad a hero? Yep. You love your dad? Yep. Do you think you should get the death penalty? Nope. You know, I have. She, at that time, she had a young son, and you know, it was a heartfelt plea for her dad's life, and it wasn't easy for her to do that. It's, you know, I mean, she didn't ask for any of this. Lori didn't ask for any of this. I mean, she's just a, you know, regular person trying to grow up normal, and you know, she's kind of saddled with being the lone person who can save her dad. But I mean, I think as most of us would probably do in that situation, you know, she testified in his behalf, and I guess, you know, if it was a gamble for John, I guess it paid off. It helped him. But maybe a decade or so later, or a couple of decades after that, you know, Lori began to think about, you know, what really happened, why her dad was arrested, you know, what had he been involved in? Then she had, and she has children of her own, and one of her children has exhibited some signs of perhaps being mentally ill. And Lori thought, well, you know, here's my dad. He's in prison for being an arsonist. Maybe there's a family history of mental illness. Maybe, you know, I can ask him, like, hey, have you ever been diagnosed with mental illness? Do you know what it's called? Do you know what kinds of help I can get? Or is there a family history of it? And so she writes him a letter and explains what kind of what's going on and what she's looking for. And John flips out. Says, no, there's no history of mental illness. How dare you ask me that? It's ridiculous for you to say that. And, you know, I'm not going to talk to you if this is what you're going to accuse me of. End of the relationship. And beginning of Lori's reassessment of, you know, her dad's life. And she'll tell you, you know, she'll say, you know, that back then she was 99.9% certain that he was innocent at the time of the trial. But she'll tell you now that she's 99% certain that he's guilty. And the idea of the book, although we've talked a lot about John, the idea of the book was really to look at the family, right? A family member, somebody who, you know, is an innocent victim like Lori or Lori's daughter. You know, there are people that are in the wake of this criminal mastermind, you know, like he's got these targets, these people he doesn't even care about, but then he's also got family and he doesn't care about them either. And, you know, the toll it takes on them and their lives is not insignificant. And, you know, as victims, sometimes the family members of the criminals are overlooked.
You talk about the, or you write about the incredible incident where she is being abused by this Jerry, her mom's husband, and
boyfriend,
she doesn't want to take it anymore, and she confronts him. And then she goes to her father to tell him about this behavior. And so you talk about him being a hero to her, but that was dashed when he didn't do she really disappointed her in that area.
Yeah, I think that was probably, you know, it's interesting. I mean, if she was ever going to get an inkling of what her dad was really about, that would have, you know, early on, that would have been the, you know, the highlight moment. The Jerry, the husband, is not a good guy. He's an abusive stepdad, and the brunt, you know, the people that bear the brunt of his abuse are his wife and his stepchildren, Lori and Carrie. And Lori's convinced that, you know, her dad, this gun-toting detective Sherlock Holmes guy, you know, will come to her rescue. if she tells him what's going on at the household. And he doesn't. He wimps out. You know, he says, well, hey, that's the house you live on. That's the roof you, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but that's the roof you live under. Those are the rules you got to follow. You know, he didn't have time in his life for their problems. You know, I think for Lori, it was the beginning of the crack in his armor that would ultimately, you know. And this is, see, and the book is written, you know, in that perspective, like, you know, Lori being completely divorced from the facts of what he's doing and having this relationship with him that's, you know, not good to begin with, and slowly falling apart until they both end up in the same courtroom, and he's about to be put to death.
Yeah. It's interesting that the extraordinary effort by Prosecutor Michael Cabral, utilizing points of origin, letters to literary agents, does it seem like this narcissism really was the end of John Orr, his need?
I think that's a very good read, Dan. You know, he obviously very narcissistic. His, you know, his need to be somehow recognized for that Oley's fire was, you know, drove him writing the book, because he couldn't, you know, he just couldn't like jump up and say, hey, I set the fire, I killed those people. He had to, you know, say it in a different way, and he was very narcissistic, and his letters to the, you know, to literary agents and to, you know, people who were in the film industry are just chock full of the sort of narcissism that, you know, that we now see on Facebook every day, but in that day was a quite bold form of it, and the fact that he left a paper trail like that, you know, that and so detailed and so specific, it undid him. And Mike Cabral, you know, this like a bulldog prosecutor in this case. You know, he tore it apart. And Mike also did something else too that I didn't appreciate at the time. And that is, you know, he got the judge in the criminal case to put kind of a gag order on it so that neither side could talk to reporters. And you know, looking back, yeah, I'm certain that it was done because John was so charismatic and so manipulative that, you know, he might have been able to, you know, through the media, sway the jury somehow into believing that there was no way he was anything but a hero. So Cabral really worked that case. He became an expert in murderous arson. And in fact, he had been sort of an insurance fraud guy as a prosecutor before that. So, you know, having that background made it easy for him to, like, you know, turn the table, and it's not really insurance fraud, but it's a fraud of a sort, right? You know, the fraud of pretending you're a fireman when you're an arsonist. Co-counsel there was Sandy Flannery, nice young woman, really adept at sort of peeling apart some of the science of murder. And also, one of the things – now, remember, here's one of the things that they have to do with that prosecution. In the prosecution, they have to tear down the sheriff's lead arson guy who said the Oley's fire was electrical in nature. So part of the prosecution required tearing down their own people. And this guy, this arson investigator – you know, he was an arrogant dude who was not going to, you know, just roll over and admit that his conclusion was wrong. You know, he was, you know, nearly a hostile prosecution witness. It's fascinating, really, how it all came together. And of course, John, who through all, you know, all those years had argued that, oh, it's not electrical, it's not electrical, it's, it was arson. Now he'll tell you, oh, no, it was an electrical fire.
He'll, oh, really?
Okay. Oh, yeah. Sure. Yeah. He's got, he'll tell you, you know, it's all, you can tell from this, that, and the other thing, you know, but, I mean, at that time, he didn't say that. And he says now, well, I've reevaluated it, you know, now that I've had a chance to look at all the evidence I didn't have a chance to look at then. You know,
wow,
but,
incredible.
Yeah.
How important in this, you've looked at this so carefully, how important was the fingerprint and how important was the dogged determination that they should hang on to that idea that fingerprint was relevant and could be associated to a firefighter?
Yeah, good question, Dan. The fingerprint is everything. I mean, without the fingerprint, there's no, you know, there's no real case, right? Always is an electrical fire. There's some weird serial arsonist that they'll never catch, you know, roaming around the Central Valley. But Marv Casey is a hero. In the book, I talk a little bit about Sherlock Holmes and sort of how, you know, John Orr had a fascination with Sherlock Holmes and deductive reasoning. And fire investigations are largely, you know, an exercise in deductive reasoning, right? You know, you have to, sure. You have to examine where the fire is. You have to examine these subtle differences in how things burned or discolored, all these things, right? But separates Marvin Casey from just your average sort of detective is that he's not just looking at the scene of this fire and, you know, deductively reasoning that, you know, an arsonist came in, set up a device with a cigarette, some matches, and a piece of paper, and, you know, lit a building on fire. He's considering the totality of many other events and then deducing from that, logically, that there is no way that anybody other than a firefighter attending that conference could have set these fires. So having that fingerprint and going to the ATF right then, you know, obviously would have validated his theory, had the ATF taken, you know, done what they were supposed to do. And I think that, you know, a lot of times when, you know, in fiction, it's all, you know, it's a detective story, right? Fiction is always these great detective stories. You know, Dashiell Hammett stuff, Raymond Chandler, you know, on and on and on. Rockford Files on television. They're always about the detective. But I think Marv Casey, this arson investigator in Bakersfield, is, you know, kind of underappreciated as being, you know, a great detective and the guy that really, you know, brought the master arsonist, you know, to justice. And you know, it's kind of this little, you know, kind of a, you know, cowboy, country guy, you know, I'm sure, I mean, you know, if you met him, you'd think he's the nicest guy in the world, you know, and, you know, and very unassuming, and yet, you know, a master puzzle solver.
Yes. We have to mention Ada Deal and her grandson, Billy, Jimmy Satina, and Karen Kraus, victims.
Yeah, so let's go back. Right. So, so Ada Deal, grandmother, her grandson was Matthew Troidel. And they were killed in the Foley's fire. You know, people, you know, just regular people out on a shopping trip on a weeknight, because it was, you know, warm and they wanted to get out of the house. Jimmy Satina, you know, a good, you know, so you think about this. This fire happened in 1984. That's a long time ago. And
sure.
There's people today in, you know, in and around Pasadena where Jimmy Satina grew up. You still remember him fondly. and how close his family was, and what a good son he was, and a loving, you know, a loving kid who was on his way to success. He really was. You know, if he was going to be successful as an athlete, or if he was going to be successful in school, you know, Jimmy Citino was on the road to something. And at 17, his life was cut short. And, you know, the fourth victim, Karen Krause, you know, she, like, just a regular working woman, showed up to work, hardworking, just happened to be on the job on the wrong day at the wrong time. And, you know, her sister kind of suspected early on that her sister knew John, and
really?
Suspected that, yeah, that John may have had some involvement, but, you know, she was never really able to, you know, put those pieces together. And all these families to this day are suffering from the loss of their loved one. You know, lives cut short for no good reason other than, you know, a thrill-seeking sexual predator who got off on setting fires. That's John Orr.
There's something to be said, too, when you describe in the book the humiliation that he was a laughing stock. They considered him a wannabe cop. He didn't have a lot of things going for him compared to some other people, and it looked like, and again, this is, he's not the first, but it seems like the people that have been humiliated, at least in their minds, go on to do a lot of damage.
So, John, you know, John in Burned, you know, we describe John's motivation as being largely, or stemming largely from, a lot of humiliation he suffered at the hands of others. You know, he was humiliated by not being able to become a Los Angeles police officer. He was humiliated because he couldn't carry a ladder and become a Los Angeles fire department firefighter. He was, you know, laughed at for being the security guard who, you know, was rough with shoplifters, laughed at for being the firefighter who, you know, tried to pop gang members, laughed at and cajoled for being the, you know, the rule adherent who tried to bust the city planning commissioner. John bridled under the yoke of authority. He hated authority, just couldn't stand it. And he really couldn't stand anybody being above him. And what was worse was that a lot of times they couldn't stand him because he was insufferable. And all this, you know, combines to, you know, there's a reason why John Orr is the most prolific serial arsonist of the 20th century, and or many reasons, and, you know, and they're all wrapped up in this person who, you know, didn't live up to what he thought his expectations would be, you know, casting himself as a hero when he's a villain. Casting himself as a good family man when he's a serial philanderer and a bad father, you know, casting himself as this, you know, great arson investigator when he's really just a fire starter who, by the way, is not really very good at it. You know, you talk about this kind of, you think about it, he set a lot of fires, but only two, you know, I mean, two or three of them were significantly destructive. There must have been some, you know, motivation at that. And of course, you know, his goal of becoming the next Joseph Wamba, complete failure there. And, it's an interesting study in psychology, right? In forensic
Absolutely.
Psychology. Yeah.
Yeah, and he led a lot of devastation in his wake. I want to thank you very much, Frank, for coming on and talking about Burned, Pyromania, Murder, and A Daughter's Nightmare. For those that might want to take a look at some other of your work, this is a Wild Brew Press, so could you give us the Facebook page or the website that they might refer to?
Actually, you can go to you can go to facebook.com/crimescene, and all my books are there. I got to tell you, I really appreciate you having me on the show today. It's great to be able to talk about this book, and hopefully it'll lead to, you know, something good for Lori down the road, at least some healing for her and her daughter.
It's a fascinating book, and it's been my pleasure speaking with you, Frank. Excellent job once again with Burned. And I hope people do go check out this book. It's, a very, very fascinating story. And you want to get inside the mind of this guy, you've achieved that, certainly. Thank you very much.
You can get it on Amazon. Don't forget Amazon and Kindle, Wild Blue Press. Thanks,
absolutely.
Dan.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Good night, Frank. Thank you.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.